strangely glad of the warmth, despite the hot day.
I think something happened to him because of the net. I can't explain, but that's what I think. That's why I went to see my old teacher.
What good that old white witch do you?
Damn it, Papa, I'm trying to talk to you. You don't know anything about Dr. Von Blake, so just shut up.
He made a motion as if to rise, sloshing his coffee.
Don't you dare get up. I'm talking to you about something important. Now, are you going to listen to me? I'm not the only relative Stephen has, you know. He's your son, too.
And I'm going to him tonight.
Long Joseph was full of wounded dignity, despite the fact that it was only his fifth visit, and all of them at Rini's strenuous urging. But he had settled back now, pouting like a scolded child. She told him as much as she could, leaving out the more arcane bits of speculation and avoiding entirely the story of her last hour in Mr. J's. She was too old and far too independent to be forbidden to do what she was doing, but she could not ignore the possibility that he might decide to protect her from herself, perhaps by damaging her pad or other equipment after a few drinks reminded him he was partly descended from warrior Zulus. She could carry on with her investigation from work if she had to, but she had already involved the Polly more than she'd liked, and she was also far behind on work because of her illness. Long Joseph was oddly quiet after she finished her explanations.
I'm not surprised you almost kill yourself. Working all day and then running around with all that other mess, he said at last. That sounds like a lot of craziness to me. Something in a computer made that boy sick? I never heard of that.
I don't know. I'm just telling you what I've been thinking about and doing. I have no proof, except one very blurry picture of a city, she thought, but only because I took my pad with me to Susan's, only because I wasn't at home when that fire happened.
As if hearing her thoughts, her father abruptly said,
You think somebody came and set our flat on fire?
I don't know. I don't want to think it's that serious. I've been assuming it was just a normal fire. You know, an accident.
Because if you've been messing with the wrong people, they'll burn you out. I know about that, girl. I seen it happen.
Long Joseph stretched out his legs, staring at his stockinged feet. Despite his height, he suddenly seemed very small and very old. He leaned down, grunting softly as he felt on the floor for his shoes.
And now you think someone following you?
Maybe. I don't know. I just don't know anything right now.
He looked up at her, sullen and a little frightened.
I don't know what to say either, Irene. I hate to be hoping that my daughter is crazy in the head, but I don't like that other idea very much.
He straightened up, captured shoes in his hand.
Let me put these on. Then we better go see that boy.
After the visit, she led her father to the changing room so he could take off his ensuit, then carefully changed her own, folding it before dropping it into the chute marked for the purpose. When she had finished, she walked to the restroom, sat down on the toilet, and cried. It started modestly, but within a few moments she could barely catch her breath. Her nose was even running, but she didn't care. He was there somewhere. Her Stephen, the little baby boy with the surprised eyes who used to crawl into her bed, was there somewhere inside that body. The lights on the machines, the monitors on his skull, all the instrumentation of modern medicine, or as much of it as was available in the Durban Outskirt Medical Facility, declared that he was not brain-dead. Not yet. But his limbs were more contorted every day, and his fingers had curled into tight fists despite the physical therapy. What was that horrible, horrible phrase? Persistent vegetative state. Like a shriveled root. Nothing left but something stuck in the ground. Darkly motionless, both inside and out. She couldn't feel him. That was the most horrifying thing. Habu had said his soul was somewhere else. And although it was the sort of spiritualist homily that she usually nodded at while remaining privately scornful, she had to admit she felt the same way. The body was Stephen's, and it was still alive, but the real Stephen was not in it. But what was the difference between that and a persistent vegetative state? She was tired. So tired. The more she ran, the more she felt stuck in the same place, and she did not know where she would find the strength to keep running. At times like this, even a death as terrible as her mother's seemed a blessing by contrast. At least there was rest and peace for the victim, and some kind of release for the mourning family. Rini pulled down a hank of industrial rough toilet paper and blew her nose. Lan took some more and wiped her eyes and cheeks. Her father would be getting restless. The kind of old magazines lying around the waiting room were not the kind of magazines that would keep his attention. Why was that? Were hospital magazines only ever provided by kindly little old ladies? The scarcity of sports news or semi-naked women showed that the reading material was never selected by men. She dabbed at her face a little more as she stood in front of the mirror. The smell of disinfectant was so strong she thought her eyes would start watering all over again. That would be perfect, she thought sourly. Work hard to look like you haven't been crying, then come out of the toilet with your eyes streaming anyway. She gave her lashes a last defiant blot. Her father had indeed become restless. But he had found something to do. He was annoying a nicely dressed woman only a little older than Rini, who had slid all the way down to the end of the couch to avoid Long Joseph's attentions. As Rini approached, her father scooted a little way nearer.
A terrible ruckus, you see. Fire trucks, helicopters, ambulances.
He was recounting the fire at their flat block. Rini smiled a little, wondering if by showing up she'd spoiled the story of how he'd carried out all those women and children by himself.
Come on, Papa,
she began, then recognized the woman as Patricia Mwete, Soki's mother. They had not spoken since the disastrous conversation when Stephen's friend had fallen abruptly into seizure.
Oh, hello, Patricia, she said politely. Papa, this is Soki's mother. Sorry, I didn't recognize you at first.
The other woman regarded her face, undoubtedly still tear-stained, despite her best efforts, with a curious mixture of fear and uncomfortable sympathy.
Hello, Irene. Nice to meet you, Mr.
She nodded carefully toward Long Joseph, obviously not yet sure that he wasn't going to come sliding farther down the couch toward her.
Rini paused for a moment, uncertain of what to say. She wanted to ask why Patricia was here, but the curious, almost superstitious courtesy of hospital waiting rooms didn't permit it.
We've been visiting Stephen, she said instead.
How is he?
Rini shook her head.
Just the same.
They make you wear a foolish damn suit,
Long Joseph offered.
Like my boy had the fever or something.
It's not for that,
Rini began, but Patricia interrupted her.
Soki's in for tests. 3 days, 2 nights. Just routine.
She said that last defiantly, as if daring Rini to tell her otherwise.
But he gets so lonely, so I come to see him after work.
She lifted a package.
I brought him some fruit, some grapes.
She seemed about to cry herself. Rini knew that Soki's troubles had not been either as mild or temporary as Patricia had claimed during their last meeting. She wanted to ask more, but didn't think it was the right time.
Well, give him my best. We'd better be going. I've got a long day tomorrow.
As her father began the apparently complicated process of standing up, Patricia suddenly put her hand on Rini's arm.
You're Stephen,
she said, then stopped. The look of controlled worry had slipped. A mask of terror peeped through.
Yes?
Patricia swallowed and wavered a little, like someone about to faint. Her formal business clothes seemed the only thing keeping her upright.
I just hope he gets better,
she finished lamely.
I just hope they all get better.
Long Joseph was already heading for the exit. Rini watched him a little anxiously, as if he too were a troubled child.
Me too, Patricia. Don't forget to say hello to Soki for me, okay?
Patricia nodded her head and settled back on the couch, feeling for a magazine on the table without looking.
She wanted to tell me something,
Rini said as they waited for the bus.
Either that or she wanted to ask me something about Stephen.
What are you talking about?
Her father prodded a discarded plastic bag with the toe of his shoe.
Her boy, Soki. Something happened to him, too, while he was on the net, like Stephen. I saw him having a fit afterward.
Long Joseph looked back toward the hospital entrance.
Her boy in a coma, too?
No. Whatever happened, it was different. But his brain was affected, I know it.
They sat side by side in silence until the bus pulled up. When her father was settled into his seat, he turned to her.
Somebody should find those net people. Make them answer. Somebody should do something.
I am doing something, Papa,
she wanted to say, but Rini knew that she was not the kind of somebody he had in mind. It was dark. Even the stars barely shone, faint as mica chips in black sand. The only light in all the universe, it seemed, was the small fire burning within the circle of stones.
She heard voices,
and knew that she was listening to her own children, And yet in some way they were also a tribe of strangers, a band that traveled through unimaginable lands. Khabu was one of them, and although she could not see him, she knew he was sitting beside her, one of the thin murmur of invisible souls. A greater darkness lay on the distant horizon. The space it occupied the only part of the sky that contained no stars. It was a vast triangular shape, like a pyramid, but it stretched up impossibly high, as though they sat close to its base. As she stared at the great shadow, the voices around her murmured and sang. She knew they were all aware of that tall, dark mass. They feared it, but they also feared to leave it behind, this the only familiar thing in all the night.
"What is it?"
she whispered. A voice that she thought was Khabu's answered her.
"It is the place where the burned ones live. On this night he comes. We have to run away."
She suddenly knew that something was moving out beyond the firelight, something that lived in darkness the way fish lived in water. They were being stalked by something vast and tenebrous, and in all the twilit universe the only uncorrupted light came from the flames of this small fire.
"But he will only take a few," the voice said. "The others will be safe. Only a few." "No, we can't let him have any of them."
She reached out, but the arm she clutched turned insubstantial as smoke. The murmuring grew louder. Something was coming nearer, something huge that rattled the trees and stones, that hoarsely breathed. She tried to pull her friend back, but he seemed to come apart in her hands.
Don't go.
Old night itself was coming down on them, the jaws of darkness stretching wide.
Rini sat up, panting.
The murmuring still filled her ears, louder now, voices gasping and growling. Something was thumping in the darkness nearby. She did not know where she was.
"Quiet yourself in there," someone shouted,
and she remembered that they were in the shelter. But the sounds were not distant. Bodies were struggling on the floor only a meter away from her.
"Papa!"
She fumbled for the torch, turned it on. By its light, she could see limbs moving erratically, thrashing and rolling, banging up against the fiberboard partitions. She could see the pale, striped length of her father's pajamas, and nearby another torch lying on its side, spilling light like a tipped goblet. She rolled off the bed and grabbed Long Joseph's attacker around the neck, shouting,
"Help! Someone help us!"
There were more noises of complaint from other compartments, but some of the occupants seemed to be rousing themselves. She kept her grip on the stranger and curled her fingers in his hair, then pulled back hard. He let out a high-pitched shriek of pain and clawed at her hand. Her father used the moment's respite to scramble free. The stranger had wriggled loose from Rini, but instead of fleeing, he crawled into a corner of the compartment and huddled there with his hands wrapped around his head to ward off further attacks. Rini kept the flashlight on him, then saw her father coming back with a long, dull carving knife in his hand.
"Papa, don't!"
"I kill the bastard!"
He was breathing painfully hard. She could smell the rank alcohol sweat coming off him.
"Follow my daughter around?"
"We don't know. He could have got the wrong room. Just wait, damn you."
She crawled a little way toward the cowering stranger.
"Who are you?"
"He knew what he'd doing. I hear him whisper your name."
Rini had a moment of horror. Could it be Khabu looking for her? But even in partial darkness, the stranger seemed far too large. She reached out carefully and touched his shoulder.
"Who are you?"
she repeated. The man looked up, blinking in the torchlight. He had a cut across his hairline, which was sheeting blood down his forehead. It took her a long moment to recognize him.
"Jeremiah?"
she said.
"From Dr. Von Blake's house?"
He stared for a moment, clearly unable to see her behind the torch.
"Irene Sulawayo?"
"Yes, it's me. For God's sake, what's happening here?"
She stood. Already several people from the neighboring compartments were gathering outside the curtain, some with defensive weapons in hand. She went out and thanked them, telling them it had been a case of mistaken identity. They gradually dispersed, all relieved, some muttering imprecations about her drunkard father. She went back inside to find Jeremiah Dacko sitting against the wall, watching her father with some distrust. Rini found the small electric lantern and turned it on, then gave Dacko some paper toweling to wipe his bloodied face. Her father, who was still staring at the intruder as though he might sprout fur and fangs at any moment, allowed himself to be conducted to a folding chair.
"I know this man, Papa. He works for Dr. Von Blake.
What's he doing this hour, coming around here? He your boyfriend?
Dako snorted with indignation.
No, he's not my boyfriend. She turned. What are you doing here at...
She looked at her watch.
1 in the morning.
The doctor sent me. I couldn't find your number to call you.
She shook her head, puzzled. She has my number. I know she does.
Jeremiah stared at the blood-soaked paper in his hand for a moment, then looked up at Rini, eyes blinking rapidly.
Everybody's crying today, she thought. What's going on?
Dr. Susan is in the hospital,
he said abruptly, furious and miserable.
She's very bad. Very bad.
Oh, my God.
Rini reflexively tore off several more sheets of paper towel and gave them to him.
What happened?
Some men beat her up. They broke into the house.
Dako just held the towel. A rill of blood descended to his eyebrow.
She asked to see you.
He closed his eyes.
I think she might die.
Smugly ensconced in his role as defender of the household, Long Joseph at first insisted on accompanying them. Only after Rini pointed out that they might have to spend several hours in the hospital waiting room did he decide to remain at the shelter as a bulwark against other, less forgivable prowlers. Jeremiah drove swiftly through the nearly empty streets.
I don't know how the bastards got in. I went to see my mother. It's the night I always go. She's very old now, and she likes me to come and do things for her.
The piece of toweling gleamed on his dark forehead, Rorschached by drying blood.
I don't know how the bastards got in,
he repeated. It was obviously something he considered a personal failure, despite his absence. In such circumstances, Rini knew, the housekeeper or other employees were usually the first suspects. But it was hard to doubt Dako's misery.
Was it a robbery?
They didn't take much. Some jewelry. But they found Dr. Susan in her lab downstairs. So they must have known about the elevator. I think they tried to make her tell where she kept the money. They broke everything. Everything.
He sobbed, then clenched his lips tightly, and for a few moments drove in silence.
They destroyed things in her lab? He scowled.
They smashed things. They are like animals. We keep no money in the house. If they wanted to steal, why did they not steal the machines? They are worth more than the few rands we keep around to tip delivery boys.
And how did you know the doctor wanted to see me?
She told me, while we were waiting for the ambulance. She could not talk much.
Another sob shook him.
She was just an old woman. Who could do such a thing?
Rini shook her head.
Terrible people.
She could not cry. The streetlights sliding past had lulled her into a sort of dream state, as though she were a ghost haunting her own body.
What was going on?
Why did dreadful things keep happening to those around her?
Terrible, terrible people,
she said. Asleep, Susan Von Blake looked like an alien creature. She was festooned with sensors and tubes, and only the mummifying bandages seemed to be holding her discolored and broken body in something like human form. Her breath wheezed in and out of her parted lips. Jeremiah burst into tears once more and slumped to the floor beside her bed, hands clasped at the back of his neck as if to keep his head from flying off with the force of his grief. As horrifying as it was to see her friend and teacher this way, Rini was still in a state of cold removal. This was the second time today she had been in a hospital, standing over the body of a silent loved one. At least the Westville University Medical Center did not have a Bukavu quarantine. A young black doctor wearing a stained smock and glasses with a taped nosepiece looked in. She needs rest, he said, frowning. Concussion. Lots of bones broken. He gestured loosely down the ward full of sleeping patients. And it's not visiting time.
She asked to see me, Rini explained. She said it was important.
He frowned again, already distracted by some other thought, and wandered out. Rini borrowed a chair from beside one of the other beds. The patient in the bed, a cadaverously thin young man, blinked awake to watch her with a caged beast's eyes, but did not speak or move. She returned to the bed and adjusted herself in a comfortable position to keep vigil, taking the less bandaged of Susan's hands in hers. She had sagged into a half-sleep when she felt a pressure on her fingers. She sat up. Dr. Von Blake's eyes were open and moving from side to side, as though she were surrounded by fast-moving shapes.
It's me, Rini,
She gently squeezed. Irene, Jeremiah's here too. Susan stared at her for a moment, then relaxed. Her mouth was open, but nothing came out past the tube except a dry sound like an empty paper sack being blown along a street. Rini stood to go in search of water, but Dako, kneeling beside her, pointed to the nothing-by-mouth sign hung on the bedstand. They put wire in her jaw.
You don't need to talk anyway, Rini told her. We'll just stay here with you.
Oh, little grandmother.
Jeremiah pressed his forehead to the tube-girded arm.
I should have been there. How could I let this happen?
Susan pulled her hand free from Rini's grip and lifted it slowly until she could touch Dako's face. Tears from his cheeks ran into her bandages. Then she gradually and deliberately put her hand back into Rini's once more.
Can you answer questions?
A squeeze.
Two squeezes for no, then?
Another squeeze.
Jeremiah said you wanted to see me.
Yes.
About the thing we talked about? The city?
Yes. Rini suddenly wondered if she could be misinterpreting, since she hadn't received anything but single squeezes. Susan's face was so swollen, it was hard even to be sure of her expression. Only her eyes moved.
Do you want me to go home now and let you sleep?
Two squeezes, quite firm. No.
Okay. Let me think. Did you find the place in the picture?
No.
But you found out something about it.
The squeeze was gentle and prolonged.
Maybe?
Yes. Rini hesitated.
Did the men who hurt you, did they have something to do with this, what we talked about?
Another long, slow pressure. Maybe.
I'm trying to think of yes or no questions. This is really difficult. Do you think you could write or type?
A long pause, then two squeezes.
Then is there someone I should talk to? Someone who gave you information and who could give me the same information?
No. Then, a moment later, an additional pressure. Yes. Rini briskly named all of Susan's colleagues she could remember, but received a negative response to all of them. She worked her way through various police and network agencies, but had no better luck. As she despairingly considered the amount of time an elimination process carried out entirely in manual binary might take, Susan pushed her hand farther into Rini's and turned it so all her fingers were against Rini's palm. They moved fitfully, like the legs of a dying moth. Rini gripped the old woman's hand, trying to give comfort. Susan hissed at her.
What?
The doctor laboriously moved her fingers in Rini's palm again, where the full hand squeezes had been easy to interpret. These movements were so light and so cramped as to seem nothing more than wriggling. Rini was defeated.
This is terrible. There must be some better way. Typing, writing notes.
She can't type, Jeremiah said mournfully. Even when she could still talk. I tried before. I gave her pad to her when she said call you. But she couldn't push the squeezer keys hard enough.
Susan weakly bumped her hand against Rini's palm again, glaring from the purple and red mask. Rini stared.
That's it. That's what she's doing. Typing.
Susan opened her hand again and squeezed Rini's fingers.
But only the right hand?
Two squeezes. No. Susan bumped the heel of her hand against Rini's palm, then laboriously lifted her arm and moved it across her body. Rini gently caught it and brought it back.
I get it. You push like that when it means you're switching typing hands. That's what you mean, isn't it?
Yes. It was still a laborious process. Susan had great difficulty making Rini understand what squeezer keys the fingers of her right hand would be touching if they belonged to her left. It took almost an hour, with frequent stops for yes and no editing and correction before she had finished her message. Susan had grown weaker throughout, and during the last 15 minutes had barely been able to move her fingers. Rini stared at the letters she had jotted in the margin of the hospital diet sheet.
BLUDGANCHRITBCRFL. But it doesn't make sense. Some of it must be abbreviated.
A final, weary squeeze. Rini stood and leaned over the bed to brush her lips against Susan's broken vein cheek.
I'll figure it out somehow. Now we've kept you awake far too long. You need some sleep.
Jeremiah stood too.
I'll give you a ride back.
He leaned over the doctor.
Then I'll be right back, little grandmother. Don't you be scared.
Susan made a whistling noise that was almost a moan. He paused. She stared at him, clearly frustrated by her inability to speak. Then at Reenie. Her eyes blinked slowly. Once. Twice.
"Yes, you're tired. You sleep now."
Dako also leaned and kissed her. Reenie wondered if that was the first time he had ever done so. On the way out to the car, she had a sudden feeling that she knew what those blinks had been meant to say. Goodbye. By the time Dako dropped her off, it was past 4 in the morning. She was too full of furious, frustrated anger to sleep, so she spent the hours before dawn staring at her pad, trying every way she could to find some shape behind the sequence of letters Dr. Von Blake had given her. The databanks of the net dumped back hundreds of names from all over the world. A dozen came from Brazil alone, and almost as many from Thailand, that actually contained most of the letters in sequence. But none of them seemed particularly likely. But if she couldn't turn up any better information, she would have to contact every one of them. She watched as a code-breaking algorithm she had downloaded from the Polytechnic Library assembled thousands of combinations that fit smaller segments of the letters, a dizzying assortment that made her eyes ache and her head buzz. Reenie smoked and watched the screen, punching in additional queries as they occurred to her. The day's first light began to leak in through the cracks in the roof. Her father snored happily in his bed, still wearing his slippers. Somewhere else in the shelter, some other early riser was playing a radio, bringing in news in an Asian language she didn't recognize. Reenie was just about to call Habu, who she knew got up with the dawn, and tell him the news about Susan, when she suddenly saw the obvious thing she had missed. The last 5 letters of the doctor's laborious message. B-C-R-F-L. Be careful. Her irritation at her own weary blindness was quickly pushed aside by a clench of fear. The doctor, in the hospital with critical injuries quite possibly given to her by the very people Reenie had offended, had taken a great deal of effort to tell her old student something that should have gone without saying. Susan Von Blake was not someone who wasted effort at the best of times, let alone when struggling for every movement. Reenie set the code algorithm back to work, minus the last 5 letters, then phoned Habu. After some time, his landlady answered, keeping the visual blacked out, and said crossly that he was not in his room.
"He said he sleeps outside sometime," Reenie said. "Could he be out there?"
"That little man isn't anywhere here, I told you. Not inside, not outside. Tell the truth, I don't think he came back last night at all."
The line went dead. Her fears rapidly multiplying, she checked her mail to see if Habu had left her a message. He had not. But to her astonishment, there was a voicemail from Dr. Von Blake.
"Hello, Irene. I'm sorry it's taken me so long to get back to you."
Susan's voice sounded strong and cheerful, and for a moment Reenie was completely baffled.
"I'll try to get hold of you later tonight directly, but I'm in the middle of something right now and don't have time to talk much, so I thought I'd just dump this quickly."
It had been recorded before the attack. It was a message from another world, another life.
"I haven't found anything definite yet, but I've got a few connections that may prove fruitful. Let me tell you, dear, this whole thing is very strange indeed. I can't find anything like an actual match with your picture anywhere, and I've had every single urban area on the globe under scrutiny. I know things about Reykjavik that even the Reykjavictims, or whatever they call themselves, don't know. And although I know you don't agree, I've been running searches on image banks as well, just in case it was something cobbled up for a Simworld or a Netflix. No luck there, either. But I have had some success with statistical similarity searches. Nothing definite, just some intriguing clusters of hits. Martine should be calling back soon, and she may have some ideas, too. In any case, I won't say more until some of the calls I've put out get answered. I'm too old to enjoy looking foolish, but I'll just say I'm going to be renewing some previous acquaintances. Very previous. Anyway, dear, that's it. Just wanted to let you know I was working on it. I haven't forgotten. And I hope you haven't become so wrapped up in this yourself that you're skipping meals or sleep. You used to have a very bad habit of trying to make up for initial laziness with last-moment diligence. Not a good plan, Irene. Take care. I'll talk to you in person later."
The line clicked. Reenie stared at her pad, wishing that she could make it say more, feeling that if she could just push the right button, her teacher would come back on and tell her all the things she'd been holding back. Susan had talked to her in person later, which made the whole thing an even crueler joke. Previous acquaintances. What could that mean? She had already tried the names of all the doctor's colleagues she could remember. Rini sent the computer searching through various educational guild records, trying to match the letters of Susan's message with the names of anyone at any of the institutions that had employed her. Her eyes were blurry from staring at the pad screen, but there was nothing else to do until it was time to go to work. There wasn't a chance in hell she would be able to catch any sleep in her current frame of mind. Besides, work made it easier not to worry about Khabu. She was on her 7th or 8th cigarette since dawn, and watching a coffee tab dissolve in her cup, when someone tapped lightly on the front of the partition, near the curtain that served as the front wall. Startled, she held her breath for a moment. She looked around for something to use as a weapon, but the torch had disappeared somewhere. She decided that the cup of boiling water in her hand would have to suffice. As she moved quietly toward the curtain, her father coughed in his sleep and rolled over. She jerked back the heavy cloth. Khabu looked up at her, slightly startled. "Did I wake you?" he began, but did not finish his sentence. Rini stepped forward and hugged him so incautiously that she spilled coffee on her own hand. She swore and dropped the cup, which shattered on the concrete. End of side 10. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over. Side 11. City of Golden Shadow. Otherland, Volume 1. By Tad Williams. Continuing on page 330.
Damn! Ow! Sorry.
She waved her singed hand. Khabu stepped forward.
Are you well?
Just burned myself. She sucked her fingers.
No, I mean...
He stepped inside, pulling the curtain closed.
I had a fearful dream. I feared for you, so I came here.
She stared. He did look quite out of sorts. His clothes rumpled and clearly donned in haste.
But why didn't you call?
He looked down at his feet.
I am ashamed to say that I did not think of it. I awakened and was afraid, and set out to come here.
He squatted beside the wall. A simple, live movement. There was something about the way he did it that reminded Rini he was not entirely of her world. Something that remained archaic despite his modern clothes.
I could not find a bus, so I walked.
From Chesterville?
Oh, Khabu, you must be exhausted.
I'm fine. Healthy, anyway. But bad things have happened. She quickly told him about Dr. Von Blake, describing what she knew of the attack and its aftermath. Instead of growing wide with surprise at the news, Khabu's heavy-lidded eyes narrowed, as though he were being forced to look at something painful.
"This is very sad."
He shook his head.
I dreamed that she shot an arrow at you, and that it pierced your heart. It was a very strong dream. Very strong."
He clapped his hands softly together, then pressed them tight.
"I feared it meant that you had been injured in some way, by something the two of you had done."
"She shot something to me, but I hope it will save people, not kill them." She curled her lip. "Or at least I hope it will help us find out if I'm going mad or not." When she had finished explaining the doctor's messages and her night's work, speaking swiftly but quietly so as not to bring her father into things any earlier than she had to, the little man remained squatting on the floor, his head down.
"There are crocodiles in this river," he said at last.
In her weariness, it took her a moment to make sense of what he said.
"We have pretended as long as we could that they were only rocks pushing above the surface, or floating logs, but we can ignore them no longer."
Rini sighed. She had sparked a bit in relief at seeing Khabu safe. Now she suddenly felt that she could sleep. Sleep for a month, given the chance.
"Too many things have happened,"
she agreed.
"Stephen lost. Stephen's friend with some kind of brain damage. What happened to us in the club? Now our flat block's been burned, and Susan's been attacked and beaten. We'd be idiots not to believe something's very wrong here."
"But," she felt her anger turn sour and miserable,
"we can't prove anything. Nothing. We'd have to bribe the police just to get them not to laugh out loud when we told them.
Unless we find that city, and finding it teaches us something, or unless we go back in again."
His face was curiously blank.
"To that place."
"I don't think I could ever go back in there,"
she said. She blinked, sleepiness pulling at her very hard.
"No, I could. For Stephen. But I don't know what good it would do us. They'll just be waiting for us this time, unless we could find some better, more secret way to hack in.
She stopped, thinking. Do you have an idea? Asked Khabu. Surely a place like that would have very good... What is the word? Security.
Yes, of course. No, that's not what I was thinking. I was just remembering something Susan told me once. I had been involved in some stupid thing, messing with the college record systems, just for fun, something like that. Anyway, she was completely scorched. Not because I'd done it, she said, but because I was risking my chance to make something of myself.
Rini ran her fingers across her pad screen, calling up options.
She told me the thing itself was no big deal. All the students did it. She'd done it, she said, and lots worse. She'd been quite a daredevil in the early days of the net.
Long Joseph Sulawayo grunted and sat up in bed, stared at Rini and Khabu for a moment with no sign of recognition, then fell back into his thin mattress, snoring again within seconds.
So you are thinking,
she said, previous acquaintances. Very previous. What do you want to bet she's been talking to some of her ancient hacker buddies? What do you want to bet?
She stared at the screen.
Now, all I have to do is think up some kind of search criteria for retired online troublemakers, match it to what we've got in the way of letters, and just see if we don't come up with Dr. Susan's mystery source.
It took 15 minutes, but the hit, when it came, seemed conclusive.
Murat Sagar Singh. And look at this guy's background. University of Natal, same time as Susan. Then extended work with Telemorphics S.A., and a bunch of smaller companies over the next 20 years or so. And there's a 6-year gap just a few years after we got out of school. What do you want to bet he was working for the government or military intelligence?
But this Sagar Singh, those letters do not match...
She grinned.
Ah, but look at this. He had a handle. That's a code name that hackers used, so they could sign their work without using their real names, which tends to get you prosecuted.
She tilted the pad so Khabu could see it better.
Blue Dog Anchorite. The world must be full of Singhs, but she knew there wouldn't be many of those.
Khabu nodded. It seems that you have solved the puzzle. Where is this person?
Does he still live in this country?
Well, that's a problem.
Rini frowned.
The addresses kind of dry up about 20 years ago. Maybe he got into some sort of trouble and had to disappear. Of course, a gifted hacker can disappear in plain sight.
She ran a few more criteria through, and sat back to wait for an answer.
Girl!
Long Joseph was sitting up again, this time eyeing Khabu with obvious suspicion.
What the hell's going on here?
Nothing, Papa. I'll get you some coffee.
As she poured water into a cup, guiltily remembering the shards of her own mug which were still scattered in front of their compartment where someone might step on them, Khabu stood over her pad.
Rini,
he said, eyeing a row of listings.
There is a word coming up here several times. Perhaps it is a place or a person? I have not heard of it.
What?
Something called Treehouse.
Before she could reply, the pad's phone light began to blink. Rini set down the cup and the package of coffee tablets and hurried to answer it. It was Jeremiah Dacko, and he was crying. Before he had even said an intelligible word, Rini already knew what had happened. Chapter 18. Red and White. Netfeed, personals. Your dream come true. Visual, picture of advertiser MJ. Female version. MJ.
You see me. I'm your dream come true, aren't I? Look at these lips. Don't you want me to bite you just a little? Come visit me. I don't want little people with small ambitions. I want big boys with big ideas. We'll have such a lot to talk about and do. Just find my node, and we'll play some games that you'll never, never forget.
Galley could barely stand. Paul stooped and lifted him in his arms, and carried him out of the oyster house. The boy was sobbing so convulsively it was difficult to hold him.
No! I can't leave them! Bay! Bay's in there!
You can't help. We have to get out. They'll be coming back. The ones who did that. Galley struggled, but weakly. Paul pushed out through the door and plunged into the forest without even looking to see if they were observed. Surprise and speed were their best hopes. The light was dying, and they could be well into the thick forest before anyone followed them. He staggered for a long time with the boy in his arms. When he could run no farther,
He set the boy down as carefully as he could, and then slumped to the ground, cushioned by a thick carpet of leaves. The sky had turned the dark gray of a wet rock. The branches overhead were only wiry silhouettes. "Where do we go?" When he got no response, he rolled over. Galley was curled like a woodlouse, knees tucked, head in hands. The boy was still crying, but most of the force was gone. Paul leaned over and shook him.
"Galley, where do we go? We can't just stay here forever."
"They're gone."
It was a kind of astonishment, as though it were only now becoming clear to him.
"Gone?"
"I know. There's nothing we can do. If we don't find our way out, the same will happen to us." In fact, Paul knew that he would face worse things if his two pursuers ever caught him. But how could he know that? And how could it be true in any case? The strangers had cored the Oyster House children, torn out their insides.
"We belonged together."
Galley spoke slowly, as though reciting a lesson he wasn't entirely sure of.
"I don't remember a time when it was different. We crossed the Black Ocean together."
Paul sat up. "What ocean? Where? When did this happen?"
"I don't know."
Galley shook his head.
"I only remember traveling. That's the first thing I remember. And we were together."
"All of you? That can't have been very long ago. Some of them were only a few years old."
"We found the little ones along the way, or they found us. We're twice as many now as when I first remember. Twice as many."
His voice trailed off, and he began to weep again. A thin, hitching noise. Paul could only put an arm around the boy's shoulders and draw him to his chest. Why did this child remember more of his short life than Paul did of his own? Why did everyone seem to know more of the world than he did? The boy calmed. Paul rocked him against his chest. Awkwardly, but he had no better idea. "You crossed the Black Ocean? Where is that?"
"Far away."
Galley's voice was muffled in his chest. The day had almost failed now, and Paul could see only different forms of shadow.
"I don't know. The big ones told me about it."
"Big ones?"
"They're gone now. Some stayed behind in places they liked, or they got stuck. But the rest of us moved on, 'cause we were looking for something. Sometimes the big ones just disappeared, like..."
"What were you looking for?"
"The White Ocean. That's what we called it. But I don't know where it is. One day, the last one bigger than me was gone, and then it was my turn to lead. But I don't know where the White Ocean is. I don't know where it is at all. And now it doesn't matter."
He said this with a terrible, weary finality, and grew quiet in Paul's arms. For a long time, Paul sat and held him, listening to the night noises, trying to forget, or at least to avoid reviewing, what he had seen in the Oyster House. Crickets ratcheted all around. The wind rustled the uppermost treetops. Everything was very calm, as if the universe had paused. Paul realized there was no movement against his breast. Galley was not breathing. Paul sprang up in a panic, rolling the boy onto the ground.
"What? What are you doing?"
Galley's voice was sluggish with sleep, but strong. "I'm sorry. I thought..." He gently laid his hand on the boy's chest. There was no movement. Equally gently, moving with an instinct or memory he could put no name to, he slid his hand up to the hollow beneath the narrow jaw. He could feel no pulse. He tested himself. His own heart was beating rapidly. "Galley, where do you come from?" The boy mumbled something. Paul leaned closer. "What?"
"You're the big one now,"
Galley murmured, surrendering again to sleep.
"Bishop Humphrey, he said this was the best way."
Despite his miserable, dark-ringed eyes, the boy spoke firmly. It had been a bad night, full of bad dreams for both of them. Paul was so glad to see the daylight again that he found it hard even to argue, although he was not entirely sure he trusted the bishop's advice. He also said there was some kind of horrible something this way, something dangerous. Galley gave him a pained look, which clearly said that Paul was now the oldest and tallest, and shouldn't burden his younger subordinates with such worries. Paul saw a certain justice in this. He fell silent and concentrated on following the boy through the thick forest tangle. Neither of them spoke, which made traveling a little easier. Paul was heavily distracted. The bright morning could not quite burn away his terrible memories, either of what had happened at the Oyster House, or of the night's dreaming. In the dream, he had been a sort of herder, forcing animals onto a great ship. He did not recognize them, although there was something of sheep about them and something of cattle. Bleating, eyes rolling, the creatures had tried to resist, turning in the doorway as though to struggle for freedom. But Paul and the other silent workers had forced them up over the threshold and into the darkness. When all the animals were loaded, he had pushed the great door into place and locked it. Then, as he stepped away, he had seen that the place of imprisonment was not so much a ship as some kind of huge bowl or cup. No, a cauldron. That was the word. A thing for boiling and rendering. He could hear increasing noises of fear from within, and when he finally awakened, he was still full of shame over this betrayal. The dream memories lingered. As he tracked along behind Galley, the huge cup-shaped thing shimmered in his mind's eye. He felt he had seen it before in another world, another life, a head full of shadows, and all the sunlight in the world won't drive them away. He rubbed at his temples as if to squeeze out the bad thoughts, and almost walked into a swinging branch. Galley found a stream which ran past them all the way down to the great river beside the oyster house, and they followed its course upward, through sloping lands where the grass grew thick in the clearings, and the birds made shrill noises of warning at their approach, fluttering from branch to branch ahead of them until the invaders were safely distant from hidden nests. Some of the trees were laden with blossoms, powdery flares of white and pink and yellow, and for the first time Paul wondered what season it was. Galley did not understand the question. "It's not a place, it's a time," Paul said. "When there are flowers, it should be spring." The boy shook his head. He looked pale and incomplete, as though a part of him had been destroyed with his tribe of fellow children.
"But there are flowers here, Governor. None near the bishop's. Stands to reason all places couldn't be the same. Then everything would happen all in the same spot. Confusion, you see. Everyone'd be running into each other. A terrible mess."
"Do you know what year it is, then?" Galley looked at him again, this time with something almost like alarm.
"Year?"
"Never mind." Paul closed his eyes for a moment to simplify matters. His mind seemed full of complicated strings, all knotted together, the whole an insoluble tangle. Why should Galley, not knowing something like what year or season it was, things which he himself hadn't even thought of until just this moment, make him so uneasy? "I am Paul," he told himself. "I was a soldier. I ran away from a war. Two people, two things, are following me, and I know they must not find me. I had a dream about a big cup. I know something about a bird, and about a giant, and I know other things that I can't always put names to. And now I am in the 8 squared, whatever the hell that is, looking for a way out." It was not a satisfying inventory, but it gave him something to cling to. He was real. He had a name. And he even had a destination, at least for the moment.
"Hard climbing now," said Galley. "We're near the edge of the square."
The slope had indeed changed, and now mounted upward steeply. The forest began to thin, replaced by low, scrubby bushes and moss-covered slabs of rock, bejeweled here and there with clusters of wildflowers. Paul was growing tired, and was impressed by his companion's vigor. Galley had not slowed at all, even as Paul was forced to bend almost double against the rising angle of the ground. The whole world suddenly seemed to shimmer and blur. Paul struggled to find his balance, but in that moment there was neither up nor down. His own body seemed to grow insubstantial, to drift into component fragments. He shouted, or thought he did, but a moment later things were ordinary again, and Galley seemed not even to have noticed. Paul shivered, wondering if his own weary body could have betrayed his mind. When they reached the top of the hill, Paul turned to look back. The land behind them seemed nothing like the bishop's grid. Trees and hills ran seamlessly together. He could see the bend of the river sparkling blue-white in the sun, and the now sinister bulk of the oyster house huddling beside it. He could see the spire of Bishop Humphrey's castle through the woods, and farther away other towers jutting up through the great blanket of trees.
"That's where we're going," Galley said.
Paul turned. The boy was pointing to a spot some miles away, where a thickly forested ridge of hills descended almost to another curving stretch of the river. "Why didn't we just take a boat?" Paul watched the light bounce up from the surface, covering the wide river with a mesh of diamond-shaped glints so that it almost seemed made from something other than water, like moving glass or frozen fire.
Wouldn't that be faster?
Galley laughed,
then looked at him uneasily.
You can't cross squares on the river. You know that, don't you? The river's not like that.
But we went on it.
Just from the inn to the oyster house. That's inside a square. Permitted, like. Besides, there's other reasons to stay off it. That's why we went at night.
The boy looked at him with a worried expression.
If you go on the river, they can find you.
They? You mean those two?
Galley shook his head. Not just them. Anyone that's looking for you. The big ones taught me that. You can't hide on the river.
He could not explain any more clearly.
And at last, Paul let the subject drop.
They crossed the hilltop and began to descend. Paul could not immediately tell that they had entered into another square, as Galley called it. The land seemed much the same, gorse and bracken in the heights thickening to forested hillsides as they moved downward. The only immediate difference was that there seemed to be more animal life on this side of the hill. Paul heard rustling in the bushes, and saw an occasional bright eye peering out from the foliage. Once a drift of tiny piglets the color of spring grass came trotting out into the open, but they quickly fled, squawking in alarm or annoyance when they saw Paul and Galley. Galley did not know anything about them or the other creatures.
"I've never been here before, have I?"
"But you said you came here from somewhere else."
"We didn't come in this way, Governor. All I know about is what everyone knows about. Like that,"
he pointed. Paul squinted but could see nothing more unusual than the endlessly meshed branches of the forest.
"No," the boy told him. "You have to get down here. Lower."
Kneeling, Paul could see a single mountain peak between the trunks, so far away that it seemed painted with a thinner paint than the rest of the landscape. "What is it?"
"It's a mountain, you idiot!"
Galley laughed, for the first time all day.
"But down at the bottom of it, they say, is where the Red King is sleeping. And if someone ever wakes him up, then the whole 8 squared will just go away."
He snapped his fingers.
"Poof, like that. That's the story they tell anyway. I don't see how anyone would ever know that unless they actually woke him. And that would fairly spoil the point."
Paul stared. Except for its slenderness and height, it seemed a rather average mountain.
"What about the White King? What if someone wakes him up? Same thing?"
Galley shrugged.
"Suppose so. But no one knows where he's sleeping except her white ladyship, and she ain't telling."
By the time the sun had tilted past the topmost point of the sky, they had reached the bottomlands once more, a rolling sea of meadows and low hills interspersed with wide swathes of forest. Paul was again feeling tired, and realized that he had eaten nothing for more than a day. He felt the absence of food, but nothing like as strongly as he felt he should, and he was just about to ask Galley when the boy suddenly grabbed his arm.
"Look! On the hill behind us!"
Paul found that he was crouching almost before he understood what the boy had said. Some reflex against danger from above. Some old story his body still told had driven him down. He peered along the length of Galley's pointing finger. A shape had appeared on the hilltop. It was joined a few moments later by another, and Paul felt his heart go stone cold in his chest. But then a half dozen more shapes appeared beside the first two, one of them apparently on horseback.
"It's the Redbreasts," Galley said. "I didn't know they had taken this square, too. Do you think they're looking for you?"
Paul shook his head. "I don't know." He was not as frightened of these pursuers as he was of the two who had called at the oyster house. But he did not trust anyone's soldiers. "How far is it to the edge of the square?"
"A ways. We'll be there before sundown."
"Then let's hurry." It was hard going. The thick undergrowth tore at their clothes with branches like claws. Paul no longer thought of food, although he still felt weak. Galley took a snaking course, trying to keep them out of the densest forest for greater speed, but also away from the places where they would be most visible from the hillside. Paul knew the boy was doing a better job than he could, but they still seemed to be traveling at an agonizingly slow pace. They had just leaped from the security of a copse and were pounding across an open slope when they heard a clatter from the undergrowth. A moment later, a horse burst out and drummed across the open space in front of them, then turned, rearing. Paul dragged Galley back from beneath flailing hooves. The rider wore armor of a deep blood red, a helmet of the same color in the perfect likeness of a snarling lion's head hid his features. He stamped his long lance upon the ground.
"You cross territory that has been claimed for Her Scarlet Majesty," he said.
his self-important tones made louder and more hollow by his helmet.
"You will surrender yourself to me."
Galli struggled beneath Paul's hand. He was small and dirty, and it was difficult to keep a grip on him.
"We are free folk. What gives you the say-so to stop us going where we please?"
"There is no freedom but that of Her Majesty's vassals,"
the knight boomed. He tilted the lance so that its sharpened head wavered at the height of Paul's chest.
"If you have committed no crimes, and bind yourself to her in honorable fealty, then you will have nothing to fear."
He spurred his horse forward a few paces, until the bobbing lance almost touched them. "I'm a stranger." Paul was still struggling to catch his breath. "I am passing through. I care nothing about local troubles."
"The urchin is an outsider, too,"
the knight said through the lion's snarling muzzle,
"and he and his starvelings have caused nothing but problems since they arrived. Thieving, lying, spreading nonsensical tales. Her Majesty will have no more of it."
"That's a lie!"
Galli was on the verge of tears.
"Them are all lies!"
"Kneel, or I will treat you as harshly as one of your capons, spitboy!"
Paul pulled Galli back. The knight spurred forward. There was nowhere for them to go. Even if they could reach the trees behind them, it would only be a matter of time before he rode them down. Deadened, Paul slowly dropped to one knee.
"What? What then? Who goes there?"
Another knight now cantered into the clearing from the side nearest the river. This one dressed all in shining white, his helmet shaped like a horse's head with a single horn protruding from its brow, an animal whose name Paul felt he should remember, but couldn't. A wide array of weapons, flasks, and other objects dangled from the knight's saddle, so that his horse clattered like a tinker's wagon every time it moved.
"Avaunt!" he shouted. "Or is it a roit?"
The red knight could not keep a note of surprise from his voice.
"What are you doing here?"
The figure in white armor paused as though the question were difficult.
"Took a bit of a dodgy turn, I suppose. Unexpected. Suppose we'll have to have a battle now."
"These are the Queen's prisoners," declared Lionhelm, "and I cannot waste my time with you. I will allow you to retreat. But if I see you again, once I have finished with these,"
he waggled his lance at Paul and the boy,
"I will have to kill you."
"Retreat? Oh, hardly possible. No, can't do it. She's not my queen, you see."
The white knight paused as if trying to remember something important. He reached up and pulled off his helmet, exposing a damp halo of pale hair, and scratched vigorously at his scalp. Paul stared in astonishment. "Jack? Jack Woodling?" The knight turned to stare at him, obviously puzzled.
"Jack? I'm no Jack. See here."
He turned to the red knight.
"There's prisoners for you. I've had 'em myself. No respect. No understanding of the niceties."
"It's not him,"
Galli said in a loud whisper. Paul shook his head. This was rapidly becoming farce.
But I've met you before. The other night in the woods. Don't you remember?"
The man in white armor stared at Paul.
"In the woods? Fellow that looked like me?"
He turned again to the red knight.
"I believe this chap's met my brother. Fancy. He's been missing for some time. Always was a rover."
He swiveled again.
"Did he seem well?"
Lionhelm was neither interested nor amused.
"Turn and depart, you lackwit white, or it will go badly with you."
He drew his horse back a few restive paces, then couched his lance and pointed it at the newcomer.
"No, that won't do."
The white knight was growing perturbed.
"Have to claim this square, do you see? Her Serene and Alabaster Highnesses now, sort of thing."
He pulled his helmet on again.
"So I suppose it's a battle."
"Idiot!" screamed the red knight. "You prisoners, you will stay there until I have finished."
The white knight had now lowered his lance and was cantering forward, banging and clanking as he went.
"Prepare yourself!"
he shouted, then undercut the effect by asking,
"Quite sure you're ready?"
"Run!"
Galli sprinted past the red knight, who turned his head to bellow at the boy, only to receive his enemy's lance in the middle of his breastplate. He flailed as he lost his balance, tumbled off his horse, and fell heavily to the ground. As Paul dashed past, the lion knight was already clambering to his feet, pulling a huge and unpleasant-looking mace from a strap on his saddle.
"A good one. Oh, very good, you must admit," said the White Knight.
He did not seem to be preparing any defense as the Red Knight approached. "But he'll kill him." Paul hesitated, then took a tentative step back into the clearing as the Red Knight swung his cudgel and smashed his opponent out of his saddle and onto the damp earth. Galley grabbed his sleeve and yanked him hard, almost pulling him off his feet.
"Leave them to go at it! Come on, Governor!"
He darted down the hill again, this time retaining his grip on Paul's sleeve. Paul had no choice but to follow stumblingly after him. Within moments, the clearing was hidden in the trees behind them, but they could hear grunting, cursing, and a ponderous clang of metal on metal for some time.
"He rescued us," Paul gasped when they had stopped for a moment to rest. "We can't just leave him to die."
"The knight? Who gives a toss?"
Galley tossed his damp hair out of his face.
"He's not one of us. If he snuffs it, he'll be back again. In the next match."
"Back? Next match?" But the boy was running again. Paul staggered after him. The shadows were long and angular. Afternoon was fading quickly, the sun just resting on the spine of the hills. Paul grabbed at the boy for support when they stopped and almost dragged them both to the ground.
"Can't," he panted.
"Rest. Not for long."
Galley seemed tired also, but far less so than Paul.
"The river's just over the rise, but we've still got to follow it a ways before we reach the border."
Paul set his hands on his knees, but could not unbend his waist and stand straight.
If those two were fighting, why, we...
running. "Because there were others. You saw them on the hill. Redbreasts. Foot soldiers, but they can move steady and quick when they want to, and they don't need to stop and wheeze their guts out."
He slid to the ground.
"Catch your breath. Then we got to move fast-like."
"What did you mean before? About the knight dying?" Galley rubbed his face, leaving streaks of dirt like primitive face paint.
"Them all, they just go round and round. They fight and fight until one side wins, then it starts all over again. This is the third match since we came here. That I remember."
"But don't people get killed?"
"Course they do, but only till the end of the match, as they call it. Then everything starts up again. They don't even remember."
"But you do, because you're not from here?
Suppose..."
The boy frowned, then grew thoughtful.
"Do you think maybe all the little ones, they and the rest, will be back the next time?
Do you think?" "Has it ever happened before? Have you lost any of your little ones that way, then had them come back?" Galley shook his head. "I don't know," Paul said at last, but he thought he did know. He doubted that whatever magic protected the natives of the 8 Squared extended to outsiders. When he could stand upright again, Galley led them on. After a short trek through thick forest, they pushed through a spinney of twisted trees and found themselves looking down a long, grassy slope to the river. Paul had no chance to savor the view. Galley led him down to within a few hundred yards of the water's edge, then turned them toward the ridge of hills. They walked as quickly as they could across the sparse, sandy meadows, the sun's orange glare in their eyes, until they passed into the shadow of the hills. Paul stared out at the river and the dim breakfront of trees that ran along its farther bank. Just beside them, the shadowed water seemed full of blue gleaming depths. Behind them, outside the shadows in which they stood, it seemed to smolder in the sunset light like a long ribbon of molten gold. Somehow, the river seemed at once both more and less real than the landscape it transected, as if a feature from one famous painting had been inserted into another. He slowed for a moment, suddenly aware of a cloud of partial memories that had gradually been making themselves more and more a part of his thoughts. Famous painting? What would that be? Where had he seen or heard of such a thing? He knew what it meant without quite being able to visualize anything that would correspond to the idea.
"Hurry yourself, Governor. We want to be in the caves by dark or they'll find us."
"Why don't we just swim across the river to the other side?" Galley turned to glare at him.
"Are you barmy?"
"Or we could make a raft if it's too far. There's lots of wood."
"Why would we want to do that?"
Paul, as usual, had moved into conceptual territory where the bits of knowledge floating up did not seem to match the world around him. To escape. To get out of the 8 Squared. Galley stopped and planted his hands on his hips, scowling.
"First off, I told you, you don't want to go on the river because you can be found."
Second thing is, there ain't no other side.
What do you mean?
Just what I said. There ain't no other side. Even an Egypt knows that. You don't get out of the 8 squared that way. The river just goes past it.
Paul could not understand the distinction.
But what's that?
He pointed at the distant bank.
It's, I don't know, a mirror, sort of. A picture, maybe? But there's nothing there. That's how we lost one of the big ones. She thought she could cross, even though she'd been told.
I don't understand. How can there be nothing out there when I can see something?
Galley turned and resumed walking.
You don't have to believe me, Governor. Get yourself killed if you want. But you and me, we won't pop up again next match, I'm thinking.
Paul stood staring at the far trees for some time, then hurried after him. When the boy saw he was following, he gave Paul a look of mixed relief and disgust, but then his eyes opened wide, staring at something even farther back. Paul turned. An object was speeding across the meadow toward them, still a long distance back, and moving too fast to be clearly seen. A trail of thin smoke hung in the air where the grass smoldered in its wake.
"Run!"
shouted Galley. Despite his weariness, Paul did not need encouraging. They pelted toward the looming purple hills, whose skirts were now only 1,000 paces away. A nearer jut of stone, which Paul had at first taken to be another rock formation, revealed itself to be the work of human hands as they sped across it. The single triangular spike, taller than a man, stood at the center of a broad circle of flat stone tiles incised with strange patterns. Running across the smooth, hard face of what Paul guessed was an enormous sundial, actually sped their pace, and for a moment Paul thought they might reach the cave safely. Small animals with contorted, curving muzzles scuttled out of their path and into the surrounding scrub. They were just stumbling across the sand and rocky scree that marked the hem of the hills, when a red something rushed past them with the noise and force of a small freight train.
"Freight train?" wondered Paul, even in his disordered panic.
"What?" The thing pulled in front of them and skidded to a halt, throwing up a trailing barrage of hot gravel. Tiny stones pinged against Paul's chest and face. She was at least a head taller than he was, and bright red from head to foot. Every bit of her was the same glossy shade, even her haughty face and her unswept hair. Her vast, flared gown seemed made of something heavier and stiffer than cloth. A few wisps of smoke still drifted from beneath the hem.
"You! I am told you refused my offer of vesselage!"
Her voice was pump-engine loud, but chilly enough to freeze birds on the wing.
"That is not the way to gain my favor!"
Galley was slumped beside him. Paul sucked in just enough breath to talk without squeaking.
"We meant no offense, Your Highness. We only sought to—"
"Silence! You will speak when spoken to, but only when I tell you that you have been spoken to. Now you have been spoken to. You may speak."
"We meant no offense, Your Highness."
"You said that already. I am not sure I wish to have you as vassals in any case. You are frightfully stupid creatures."
She lifted her hand in the air and snapped her fingers, a noise as loud as a gunshot. From the trees far away along the ridge, 3 armored foot soldiers appeared and began skidding and tumbling down the hillside, hurrying to their lady's summons.
"I suppose we shall simply have your heads off. Not the most original punishment, but I find that the old ways are the best, don't you?"
She paused and glared at Paul.
"Well, have you nothing to say?"
"Let us go. We are leaving. We have no wish to interfere."
"Did I say you had been spoken to?"
She frowned, honestly pondering.
"Ah, well, if I remember, and it turns out you have spoken out of turn, I shall simply cut your head off twice."
The soldiers had reached flat ground and were hurrying toward them. Paul considered trying to dodge past the queen and sprint for the beckoning darkness of a large cave in the rocks only 100 paces away.
"I see you," said the queen. "I know what you are thinking."
There was not an iota of levity or human feeling in her voice. It was like being trapped by some horrible machine.
"You may not plot escape without permission either. Not that it would do you any good."
She nodded. An instant later, she was 10 paces to one side. Paul had seen only a brief scarlet blur.
"You are much too slow to outrun me," she pointed out, "although you have moved a little more swiftly than I would have guessed. It is most infuriating when pieces come into the 8 squared and move just as they choose. If I knew who was responsible, heads would roll, I promise you."
She momentarily blurred again, ending up less than a yard from Paul and the boy, staring down at them with evident distaste.
"Heads will roll in any case. It is only a question of which and how many."
The first of the soldiers trotted up, closely followed by his 2 companions. Before Paul could shake off his surprise at the Queen's astonishing speed of movement, strong and ungentle hands pulled his arms behind his back.
"It seems there was something else,"
the Queen said abruptly. She raised one scarlet finger to her chin and tilted her head to the side, woodenly childlike.
"Was I perhaps going to cut some other parts of you off instead of your heads?"
Paul struggled uselessly. The 2 soldiers who held him were as painfully solid as the Queen appeared to be. Galli was not even trying to fight free of the man-at-arms who held him.
"We have done no harm," Paul cried. "We are strangers here."
"Ah!"
The Queen smiled, pleased at her own cleverness. Even her teeth were the color of fresh blood.
"You have reminded me. Strangers!"
She lifted her fingers to her mouth and whistled, an ear-jabbing blast of sound that echoed from the hillstones.
"I promised I would hand you over to someone. Then I will have the heads off whatever is left."
Paul felt a sudden chill that moved through him like a damp wind from the night ocean. He swiveled, knowing what he would see. 2 figures had appeared on the meadow behind them, both wearing hats and cloaks. Their faces shadowed. They moved forward deliberately, with no apparent haste, as the smaller of them spread its arms in a horrible mock display of surprise and pleasure. Something glinted in the shadow beneath its hat brim.
"There you are!"
The voice made Paul want to scream and bite at his own flesh.
"We had wondered how long it would be until we found you again."
Galli moaned. Paul threw himself forward, trying to break free, but the Queen's soldiers had him gripped fast.
"We have such special things waiting for you, our dear old friend."
The pair were closer now, but still not quite distinguishable, as though they carried some deeper darkness wrapped around them in a cloud.
"Such special things."
Even as Paul's knees gave way and he sagged into the strong arms of his captors, he heard a strange sound. Either Galli's moaning had become almost as loud as the Queen's whistle had been, or the rumbling grew stronger. Paul dragged his eyes from the terrible yet fascinating spectacle of his pursuers and looked toward the hills. He wondered if an avalanche were beginning. Surely only the friction of stone on stone could make such a deep, grating noise. But there was no avalanche, only a vast winged thing that growled as it emerged from the cavern in the hillside. Paul stared. The Queen's mouth hung open.
"Jabberwock!" choked one of the soldiers.
A hopeless, terrified sound. Once out of the confining cave, the thing stood and spread its wings until the tips rose high enough to catch the sun's last rays in their veined membrane. The heavy-lidded eyes blinked. The head snaked forward on the end of an impossibly long neck. Then the wings bellied and cracked as the creature took flight. Galli's captor toppled over onto his back, where he lay making a thin screeching noise. The beast went straight up until it hung in the bright sky above the hilltops, a black silhouette like a bat stretched across a lantern, then dropped into a dive. The soldiers holding Paul both let loose at the same moment and turned to run. The Queen raised her arms and bellowed at the thing as it descended. Paul was staggered and then toppled by the gale as the creature spread its vast wings and banked upward, one of the terrible cloaked figures kicking in its bird-like grip.
"Galli!"
screamed Paul. There was dust everywhere, swirling funnels of it. Somewhere,
Through the grit and shadow and rush of wind, he could hear the outraged screams of the Red Queen.
"Galley!"
He found the boy huddled on the ground and snatched him up, then turned and began running toward the river. As they stumbled across the uneven terrain, the boy glanced up and saw their destination.
"No! Don't!"
Paul splashed into the shallows with the struggling child in his arms. As he waded out into the current, he heard a voice calling from the chaos behind them.
"You are only making it worse. We will find you wherever you go, Paul Jonas."
He let the boy go, then began swimming toward the far bank. Galley was floundering beside him, so Paul caught the boy's collar and kicked hard against the water and the tangling reeds. Something swooped past overhead, the wind of its passage beating the water into white caps. A scarlet figure that shrieked like a boiling kettle dangled in its claws. The waves battered Paul and pushed him back toward the bank. He was growing weak, and the other side of the river was still very far away.
"Swim, boy,"
he gasped, letting Galley go. Together they struggled a little farther, but the current was sweeping them apart and also pushing them at a right angle to the bank, which seemed to grow no closer. A cramping pain shot through Paul's leg. He gasped and slid under, then thrashed in circles in the muddy water, trying to find his way upright again. Something was gleaming nearby, something distorted but bright, like a candle seen through wavy glass. Paul struggled to the surface. Galley was paddling desperately beside him, chin barely held above the water, panic on his straining face. Paul stuck his head under the water again. It was there, something golden, shimmering in the depths. He broke the surface, grabbed Galley, and pushed the boy's mouth shut.
"Hold your breath,"
he gasped, then dragged them both under. The boy fought wildly. Paul kicked as hard as he could, trying to drive them both downward toward the distorted glow. Galley caught him with an elbow in the stomach, and air leaked from him. Paul coughed and felt the river rush into his nose and mouth. The yellow gleam seemed nearer now, but so was the blackness, and the blackness was closing in swiftly. Paul reached out toward the bright spot. He saw black water, swirling yet stone solid, and bubbles, golden lit, trapped as though in amber. He saw a frozen moment of Galley's face, eyes bulging, mouth wide in betrayed horror. Paul reached out. Then everything went away. Chapter 19. Fragments. Netfeed News. Indoor storm kills 3. Visual. Beach wreckage. Torn dome overhead. V.O. 3 people were killed and 14 more hospitalized when an artificial indoor beach attraction went out of control in Bournemouth, England. Visual. Bubble Beach Park during normal operation. Malfunctioning wave machines and the collapse of the building's domed ceiling caused what one witness called an indoor tsunami that resulted in 3 drownings and numerous other injuries when 16-foot-high waves swept up onto the artificial beach. Sabotage has not been ruled out. She had avoided it for 2 days, but she couldn't any longer. The doctor's death had raised the stakes. It was time to start looking for help, and this particular source couldn't be ignored, however much she might wish to. At least now she could do it at work, which wasn't quite so awful as having the squalor of the shelter all around her. She didn't dare black out the visual. It would be an admission of something, or it would be perceived that way, that she had gotten fat, or that she couldn't face him. Reenie tilted the pad so that she would be posed in front of the least cluttered wall and the one potted plant which had survived the toxic office atmosphere. She knew the number. She had tracked it down the day after Susan's death. It had been something to do, something to keep her active. But she had realized, even at the time, that if she found it, she would have no choice but to use it. She lit a cigarette, then looked around the office again, making sure that nothing in view of her pad's wide-angle lens looked too pathetic. She took a deep breath. Someone knocked at the door.
"Damn! Come in!"
Habu poked his head inside.
"Hello, Reenie. Is this a bad time to visit you?"
For a moment, her mind leaped at the chance of a reprieve.
"No. Come in."
It was disgusting, groveling after excuses this way.
"Well, actually it is a bad time. I have to make a phone call I don't really want to make, but I'd better do it. Will you be on campus for a while?"
He smiled. "I came to see you. I will wait."
For a moment she thought he meant he would wait in the office, a breathtakingly daunting prospect. But the small man merely bobbed his head and backed out, shutting the door behind him.
Right.
She took another drag on her cigarette. They were supposed to be relatively harmless, but if she smoked many more today, she would set herself on fire from the inside. A genuine case of spontaneous human combustion. She called the number. The male receptionist left the screen blacked, which was fine with her.
I'd like to speak with Mr. Chiume. Tell him it's Rini. Irene Sulueo.
Much as she disliked her full name, she had been given it in honor of a hugely fat, hugely Christian great-aunt, it might establish a proper tone of detached adulthood. He answered quickly enough to catch her off balance, the visual flicking on as abruptly as if he had leaped out of a cupboard. Rini, I am really surprised, but it's a good surprise. How are you? You look great. Delray looked good himself, which was probably why he'd brought the subject up. Stylish, if slightly conservative, haircut. Nice suit. Shirt collar embroidered with metallic thread. But more had changed than just the shedding of his student guise. He looked different in some deeper, more profound way that she couldn't immediately categorize.
I'm okay.
She was pleased with how steady her voice sounded.
Things have been interesting, but I'll tell you about that in a moment. How is your family? I talked to your mother for a minute or so, but she was just leaving.
He briskly filled her in. Everybody was doing well except for his younger brother, who had been in conflict with authority almost since his cradle days, and continued to fall into and, usually, out of trouble.
Rini felt a little dreamy watching Delray talk, listening to his voice. It was all very strange, but not as painful as she'd expected. He was a completely different person than the one who had left her, who had, as she'd felt sure at the time, broken her heart forever.
Not that he'd changed so drastically. It was more that he no longer mattered much. He might as well have been a friend's ex-lover, and not her own. So that's my story, he said. I'm sure yours makes better listening, and I'm ready to hear it. Somehow I'm sure you didn't call me just for the sake of old times.
Damn,
thought Rini. Delray might be a bureaucrat now. He might be a suit of the very kind they used to make fun of, but he hadn't become stupid.
I seem to be in some trouble, she said, but I don't feel comfortable talking about it on the phone. Could we get together somewhere?
Delray hesitated.
He's got a wife, she realized, or a steady girlfriend. He doesn't know what exactly I'm asking for.
I'm sorry to hear you're having a problem. I hope it's nothing serious.
He paused again.
I suppose...
I just need your advice. It's nothing that will get you in any trouble, not even with the woman in your life.
His eyebrow went up. Did Mama tell you?
I just guessed. What's her name?
Dolly. We got married last year. He looked a little embarrassed. She's a solicitor.
Rini felt her stomach churn.
But again, it was not as bad as she'd anticipated.
Delray and Dolly?
Please.
I assume you don't go out much.
Don't be nasty. You'd like her if you met her.
I probably would.
The idea, in fact the whole conversation, made her feel tired.
Look, you can bring her along if you want to. This isn't some desperate attempt by a jilted lover to lure you back.
Rini! He seemed honestly indignant. That's foolish. I want to help you if I can. Tell me what to do. Where should we meet?
How about someplace on the Golden Mile, after work?
She would have a long bus ride back to the shelter, but at least she could do her groveling for favors in a pleasant atmosphere. Delray named a bar, quickly enough that she guessed it was a regular hangout of his, and asked her to give his best to her father and Stephen. He seemed to be waiting for news about them, her half of an informational hostage exchange. But there wasn't much she could tell without opening the whole thing up. She ended the conversation as quickly as she decently could, and disconnected.
He looks tame,
she realized. It wasn't just the suit or the hair. Something that had been a little wild was gone, or at least very well hidden.
Is that me, too? Did he look at me and think, well, there she is, turned into a drab little teacher?
She straightened up, stubbed out the cigarette, which had burned down unsmoked, and lit another.
We'll see about that.
Perversely, she felt almost proud of her strange and extensive problems.
When was the last time he or his little Dolly wife had their house burned down by an international conspiracy of fat men and Hindu deities?
Habu returned a few minutes later. But she didn't stop giggling for some time. It was close to hysterical, she knew, but it beat the hell out of crying. Delray regarded Habu carefully. It was almost worth the extreme discomfort of having to meet him, to watch him struggle to figure out who the Bushman was and what his position was in Rini's life. "Nice to meet you," he said, and shook the small man's hand with an admirably firm sincerity.
"Delray is an assistant minister with UNCOM,"
she explained, although she'd already told Habu that on the ride over. She was pleased she'd brought her friend along. It tipped the balance in a subtle way, made her feel less like a discarded girlfriend begging a favor.
"He's a very important fellow."
Delray frowned, hedging his bets in case he was being teased. "Not very important, actually. A career man, still in the early stages." Habu, who did not have the polite chit-chat reflexes of the urban middle class, simply nodded and then sat back against the thick cushion of the booth to stare at the antique, or imitation more likely, swag chandeliers and heavy wooden paneling. Rini watched Delray summon a waitress, impressed by his casually proprietorial attitude. During the previous century, the bar would have been the preserve of white businessmen, a place where he and Rini and Habu would have been discussed under the general heading of the Kaffirs, or the Black Problem. But now Delray and other black professionals sat enthroned amidst the trappings of colonial empire. At least that much had changed, she thought. There were more than a few suited white men in the room, white women, too, but they were only part of a clientele that also included blacks and Asians. Here a form of real equality prevailed, at least, even if it was an equality of wealth and influence. The enemy now had no identifying color. Its only recognizable attribute was discontented poverty. Habu ordered a beer. Rini asked for a glass of wine.
"Just one drink," she said. "Then I'd like to take a walk."
Delray raised his eyebrows at this. He continued to make casual conversation as the drinks came, but with a sort of wariness, as though he suspected that any moment Rini might spring some unpleasant surprise. She skirted the main issue, telling him of Stephen's condition and of the fire without a hint of what might connect the two.
"Rini, that's terrible. I'm so sorry."
He shook his head.
"Do you need something? Help finding a place? Money?"
She shook her head, then swallowed the last of her wine.
"No, thank you. But you're kind to ask. Can we take that walk now?"
He nodded, bemused, and paid the bill. Habu, who had drunk his beer in silence, followed them out onto the promenade.
"Let's walk down the pier,"
Rini suggested. She could tell that he was growing irritated. But Delray had indeed become a politician. If he had still been his student self, he would have been angrily demanding answers, wanting to know why she was wasting his time. Rini decided that she approved of at least some of the ways he had changed. When they reached the end of the pier and were alone except for a few fishermen and the purring of the breakers, she led them to a bench.
"You will think I'm crazy,"
she said,
"but I don't feel comfortable talking inside. It's very unlikely anyone can eavesdrop on us out here."
He shrugged. "I don't think you're crazy." His voice sounded less certain than his words.
"Someday you may be glad I'm taking such trouble. I don't particularly want to meet your wife, Delray, but I don't want anything to happen to her either, and I seem to have gotten myself in trouble with people who aren't very selective."
His eyes narrowed. "Why don't you just talk to me?" She started from the beginning, staying as general as she could and skipping as lightly as possible over the several times she had misused her position at the Poly or subverted UNCOM regulations. From time to time, she asked Habu to corroborate what she was saying, and the small man did, although always with a somewhat distracted air. Rini could spare little attention, but she wondered briefly at his mood and what it might signify. Delray was largely silent, breaking in only to ask specific questions. He seemed interested by the inner workings of Mr. J's, but only shook his head, expressionless, when she told him of her speculations about the club. When she had brought him up to the present, describing the fire in her flat block and Susan's murder, he did not respond immediately, but sat watching a gull preen itself on a railing.
"I don't know what to say. The whole story is astonishing."
"What does that mean?"
A spark of anger flared.
"Does that mean astonishingly crazy? Or astonishing so you'll do whatever you can to help me?"
I just don't know. It's a lot to absorb."
He stared at her.
perhaps trying to gauge how well he knew her after all these years without contact. And I'm not quite sure what you want me to do, either. I'm not part of UNCOM security or law enforcement. I'm a business liaison, Rini. I help chain stores make sure their systems follow UN guidelines. I don't know anything about the stuff you're talking about.
Damn it, Delray, you're part of the Politburo, as we used to call it. You're an insider. You must be able to do something, if only help me get information. Are these people under investigation at all? Has anyone beside me had weird experiences with this happy juggler novelty corporation? Who are they? I need answers from someone I can trust. I'm scared, Delray.
He frowned. Of course I'll do what I can.
Also, I think I need to get into Treehouse.
Treehouse? What in hell for?
She briefly considered telling him of Susan's deathbed message, but decided against it. Susan's laborious last words were known only to her, Khabu, and Jeremiah Dako. She would keep them secret a while longer.
I just need to go there. Can you help me?
Rini, I never made it into Treehouse when I was a hash-smoking full-time student hacker.
He smiled self-mockingly.
Do you think I could get within miles of it now that I'm part of the UNCOM establishment? We're the enemy as far as they're concerned.
Now it was her turn to frown.
This isn't easy. You know I wouldn't ask if I didn't really, really need help.
She blinked hard.
Damn it, Telray, my baby brother is...
She stopped, unwilling to go any farther in that dangerous direction. She would die before she would cry in front of him.
He stood,
then reached down to take her hand. He was still very handsome.
I'll check around, Rini.
Really, I will. I'll see what I can find.
Be careful. Even if you think I'm crazy, just pretend I'm not and make your mistakes on the side of caution. Don't do anything stupid, and don't be obvious.
I will call you by the end of the week.
He extended his hand to Khabu.
Nice to have met you.
The little man accepted the handshake.
Everything Ms. Sulawayo spoke of is true, he said gravely. These are bad people. You must not take this lightly.
Delray nodded, a little flustered, then turned back to Rini.
I'm truly sorry about Stephen. Give my regards to your father.
He leaned forward and kissed her on the cheek, squeezed her once, then turned and walked back up the pier.
Rini watched him go. When we broke up, she said at last, I couldn't imagine life without him.
Always things change, said Khabu. The wind blows everything. I am frightened, Rini.
She looked up. He had been silent for most of the bus ride,
staring up at the buildings as they traveled through the windowed canyons of downtown Durban.
Because of what happened to Susan?
He shook his hand.
I mourn for her, yes, and I am angry at the people who did such a terrible thing, but I am frightened in a bigger way.
He paused, looking down, his hands folded in his lap like a child threatened into good behavior.
It is my dreams.
You said you dreamed of something bad happening to me the night Susan was attacked.
It is more than that. Since we went into that place, that club, my dreams have been very strong. I do not know what I fear exactly, but I feel that I am... No, that we are all being stalked by something large and cruel.
Rini's heart sped.
She had dreamed something like that herself, hadn't she? Or was she remembering some dream of Khabu's, described by him, then absorbed as her own?
I'm not surprised, she said carefully. We had a terrible experience.
He shook his head sternly.
I am not speaking of that kind of dreaming, Rini. Those are the dreams that trouble individuals, made up of the things in their own lives, the dreams of city people, if you will not take offense at my saying it. But I am speaking of something different, a kind of ripple in the dream that is dreaming us. I know the difference. What has come to me in the past days is the kind of dream my people have when the rain will soon fall after a long drought, or when strangers are approaching across the desert. This is a dream of what will be, not of what has been.
You mean seeing the future?
I do not know. It does not seem that way to me, any more than seeing the shadow of something and knowing that the thing itself will follow is seeing the future. When Grandfather Mantis knew that his time on this earth was ending, when he knew that the time had come at last to sit down at the campfire with the All-Devourer, he had such dreams. Even when the sun is high, we know that it will sink again and night will come. There is nothing magical about such knowledge.
She didn't know how to respond. Ideas like that irritated her sense of the rational.
but she had never found it easy to dismiss Khabu's concerns and insights.
Let's say I believe you, just for the sake of discussion. Something is stalking us, you said. What does that mean? That we have made enemies? But we know that already.
Outside the bus window, the gleaming security towers of the business district were being supplanted by an increasingly shabby landscape of jerry-rigged flat blocks and storefront businesses, each with its own garish squirt of chemical neon on the front. The street crowd seemed purposeless from her perspective, eddying randomly like an inanimate liquid thing.
I am speaking of something greater. There is a poem that I was taught in school, an English poet, I think. It spoke of a beast slouching toward Bethlehem.
I remember that, sort of. Blood-dimmed tides. Anarchy loose in the world.
He nodded. An apocalyptic image, I was told. A vision of the end of things. I spoke a moment ago of Mantis and the All-Devourer. Grandfather Mantis was told in a vision that a great time of change was coming, and he prepared his people to leave the earth forever, because their time upon it had finished.
His small, fine-featured face was solemn, but she could see something in his eyes and the set of his mouth, a kind of feverish despair. He was terrified.
I feel that I am being granted such a vision, Rini. There is a great change coming, what were the words? A rough beast waiting to be born.
A chill ran across the surface of Rini's skin, as though the bus cabin's long-expired air conditioning had suddenly sprung back to life. Was her friend going mad? He had said that city life had destroyed many of his people. Was this obsession with dreams and the myths of his ancestors the beginnings of a religious mania that would eventually destroy him, too?
I've done this to him. Bad enough that he's had to adjust to a completely different kind of life. But now I've dragged him right in over his head, into the weirdest things our society has to offer. It's like dropping a young child onto a battlefield, or into an S&M orgy. "And what should we do?"
she asked, struggling to remain at least outwardly calm.
"Where is this threat coming from? Do you know?"
He stared at her for a moment.
"Yes. I could not say what are its causes, or what the results might be, but I do not need those things to sense the place the problem comes from. Even a blind man can find the campfire. I told you that the club, Mr. J's, was a bad place. It is, but it is not the heart of the shadow. I think it is like a hole in some very large nest of hornets. Do you see? If you put your ear to that hole, you will hear the sound of things that fly and seize and sting. But even if you seal it with mud, the hornets are still alive in the darkness inside, and they will find their way out of other holes.
I'm confused, Khabu. I don't really know what you're saying.
He gave her a tiny, sad smile.
I do not know exactly myself, Rini. Just because I can see the shadow does not mean I can recognize what casts it. But there is more involved in this thing than merely your brother. More, perhaps, than even the lives of many other children like him. I smell it like I smell the approach of a storm.
I may not be able to understand any more clearly than that, but it is enough to frighten me very badly.
They continued in silence until Khabu got off at his stop in Chesterville a few minutes later. Rini waved to him from the window as the bus pulled away, but his words had upset her. She was torn. It was hard to know which was worse, to believe that her friend might be going mad, or to think that he might truly know something that others did not, something dreadful. The sun was going down as her bus headed toward Pinetown. The square, drab buildings cast long shadows. Rini watched the orange street lamps kindle, and tried to imagine what kind of beasts might wait in the darkness beyond the circle of light. Delray was smiling, but he did not seem entirely happy to receive her call. Rini moved the exam she'd been preparing to one side of the screen, then enlarged Delray's window.
"Have you found out anything?"
He shook his head. "This isn't a good time for me to talk."
"Then would you like me to meet you somewhere?"
"No. Look, I don't have much for you yet. It's a tricky situation. There's been a lot of interest in the corporation you asked about, but nothing obviously out of the ordinary. They own a bunch of clubs, some production companies, a couple of gear houses, mostly net-related stuff. There was one court case involving one of their other clubs that got as far as a lower court in China, filed by a woman named Chu An."
"What do you mean, court case? What about?"
Again, he shook his head.
A suit for negligence, something like that. It's probably nothing. The family dropped it before trial. Look, there's not much I can find out without getting access to sealed legal records. And it's not something I'm supposed to be doing, really.
He hesitated.
How's Stephen? Any better?
No. Things have been pretty much the same for weeks now. She had dreamed of Stephen the night before, of him screaming for help at the bottom of a deep hole while she tried to explain the urgency to some kind of policeman or the petty official who was paying more attention to stroking a sleek dog. Just thinking about the dream made her angry. So is that all you're going to tell me? There's not much? What about the people who own that horrible place? There must be names on the licenses, or is that too much trouble to find out?
For a moment his professional composure slipped. I don't have to do anything for you at all, you know.
No. She stared at the screen,
wondering what exactly she had once found so utterly engaging about him. He was just a nice-looking man in a suit.
No, you don't.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean... I want to help Rini. Things are just... He hesitated. Things are difficult for me at the moment.
She wondered if he was referring to his domestic life, or ordinary work crises, or something more sinister. Well, I meant what I said. Be careful. And I do appreciate your help.
I'll get you everything I can. It's... Well, it's just not as easy as it sounds. Take care.
I will. Thank you. When he had hung up, she lit a cigarette, too unsettled to get back to work on the examination. It was hard to tell whether Delray's apparent agitation had to do with guilt over the way their relationship had ended, discomfort at having become embroiled in someone's bizarre conspiracy theory, or something else entirely. If it was the second thing, she couldn't really blame him. 6 months ago, if someone had brought the same crazy story to her, she would have been doubtful, too. Even now, a strong case could be made that she had merely hit a patch of bad luck and was finding a way to string it all together into a structure that made sense. Wasn't that the way someone said religions and paranoid obsessions got started, as an attempt to make sense of a universe too large and too random for human comprehension? What did she have, really? Her brother had mysteriously fallen ill, but strange, inexplicable illnesses were the stuff of historical record since time out of mind, and continued right up until the present day. There had been more sudden outbreaks of previously unknown viruses in the past 50 years than there had been in the 5 centuries before. She and Khabu had discovered a seeming correlation between the incidences of coma and net usage, but there were dozens of other possible explanations for that. Her flat block had burned, and although there had been no definitive report, there were certainly whispers of arson. But that, too, was remarkably unremarkable. She had no idea of the statistics, but she was quite sure there must be hundreds of arson fires in Durban every year, not to mention the thousands of accidental ones. The only things that even halfway held up as evidence were the murderous attack on Susan, the truly peculiar events surrounding Mr. Jay's, and the appearance of that astonishing Golden City. But even these things could be odd but explicable happenstance. Only the strong links between these apparent coincidences separated her certainty that she was onto something from the most pathetic examples of persecution mania. Rini sighed. So are Khabu and I legitimate whistleblowers? Or are we turning into the kind of people you see on the tabnets claiming space aliens are beaming messages into their brains? Susan hadn't thought so, or at least she had discovered something she thought was significant, even if Rini hadn't found a way to follow it up yet. Dr. Von Blake had not been the kind of person to indulge anything she judged unwarranted foolishness in even her closest of colleagues, let alone an ex-student she hadn't seen in years. What did she find out? What if we can't locate this Murat Sagar Singh? Or what if we do, but he doesn't know what it was that Susan thought was significant? It was terrible to think she might have brought that dreadful attack onto her mentor, but it was also frustrating to think of the doctor working in her lab that night before it happened, perhaps discovering all manner of important things, even taking time to leave a message for her, but not bothering to record any of it. Who ever expected the world to change that rapidly? But it did. Rini had been unsealing another pack of cigarettes, but now she dropped them on the desk and asked her pad to call Susan's house, hoping to reach Jeremiah Dacko. The doctor's voice came on with her voicemail, dry and brisk. "This is Susan Von Bleak. I'm doing something interesting right now. Yes, at my age.
Leave a message, please." Rini found it hard to speak for a moment, but when she regained her voice, she asked Jeremiah to call her as soon as he could. She picked up her cigarettes again and moved the exam template back to the center of the screen. Jeremiah Dacko hung back at the door of the elevator.
"I cannot look at that place today."
His eyes were red, and he looked 10 years older than the first time Rini had seen him.
"It makes me too angry, too sad."
"That's no problem." Rini let Khabu step out and patted Dako's arm. "Thank you for letting us have a look. I hope we find something. We'll come back upstairs if we need you."
"The police have been here and gone. I suppose it doesn't matter what you touch anymore."
He helped Rini lift her bags out onto the floor and then pushed the button. The door shut. The elevator hummed upward, and Rini turned for her first look at the lab. "Oh, my God!"
Sour liquid rose in her throat, and she swallowed hard. She had not expected the damage to be so extensive.
The people who had beaten Susan so viciously
had done a savagely thorough job on her workplace as well.
They must have brought sledgehammers with them.
Every single one of the long tables had been smashed to the ground, and its contents pulverized.
Flindered housings and shattered components made a carpet of plastic mulch 1/2 foot deep across nearly the entire lab floor. A jigsaw puzzle without a solution. The screens on every wall had been shattered, too, their inner workings wrenched out through the jagged holes, cables dangling like the innards of a medieval torture victim.
Khabu looked up from where he squatted, sifting jagged bits of debris through his fingers. "Surely these men were not merely robbers. No robber would spend so much time ruining expensive equipment, even if they were looking for money instead."
"I can't imagine it. God almighty, look at this."
The thoroughness of the ruin exerted a horrifying fascination. Universal entropy demonstrated for beginners. "Pay attention," the wreckage seemed to declare. "Some things cannot be undone, short of time pivoting in its groove and crawling back on itself."
Rini tried to imagine such a thing, like a video clip running in reverse, every ruptured piece flying back to its original site. Equipment reforming, tables rising again like animals startled awake. And if she could run it all back, Susan would return too, the spark of life leaping back into her cold body, her bones re-knitting, the spatters of dried blood hidden under this wreckage, liquescing and flowing together like mercury to leap from the floor and back into the doctor's closing wounds. Death itself would turn coward and flee. Rini shuddered. She suddenly felt weak and sick. It was all too terrible, too hopeless.
End of Side 11. To continue, turn the cassette over. Side 12. City of Golden Shadow. Otherland, Volume 1. By Tad Williams. Continuing on page 361.
She looked at Khabu as he idly handled the broken pieces of the doctor's work, at his slender, childlike back, and the weight of her responsibility returned to her. At this moment, it was not an unpleasant sensation. People needed her. Susan was gone, and this horrible thing could not be undone. Better to think about real things, problems that could be solved. She took a breath, unsnapped one of the equipment bags she'd borrowed from the poly, and lifted out a small station note. Her hands were shaking. She cleared a place on the floor next to a wall port and jacked it in. "We'll just hope this station box has enough power to run the domestic system," she said, pleased with the steadiness of her voice. Crisis passed. "Jeremiah said he's had to turn the lights and everything else on and off manually, so they've disabled it somehow. Could ordinary criminals do that? There's a lot of bootleg house-busting gear to be had these days, some of it very cheap. But I wouldn't think Susan would be the kind of person to leave her home vulnerable to that kind of assault, which suggests they must have had a pretty good package. I'll be able to tell you more if I can get into the house system."
Khabu frowned. "Did the police not investigate this?"
"Of course they did. Murder of a rich and well-known professor. Jeremiah said they were down here for 3 days. The private guard people, too. And you and I certainly answered enough questions about our last afternoon here. But even if they found something, they won't share it with us civilians. I tried. Jeremiah tried. About 6 months from now, we might find out something useful. We can't wait that long."
She turned on the station note, which blinked instantly to life. It was a very nice piece of Asian hardware, which, if she dropped it anywhere between here and the Polly's lab,
would cost her about half a year's salary to replace. Let's see what's left and what it can tell us. Reenie slumped into the chair. Dako poured tea for her.
Will your friend want some?
I guess so. She stared at the steaming cup, too tired for the moment even to lift it. Dako hesitated, then sat down across from her.
Did you find anything? Anything to catch those murderers?
He held his own cup in trembling fingers. Reenie wondered what it had been like for him to come back to this house the first time after the doctor's death. No. They put some kind of data killer into the house system. I've tried every form of retrieval gear I could lay my hands on. It's a wonder anything still works here at all.
The doctor made sure everything ran in parallel. That's what she called it. In case the system broke down.
There was quiet pride in his voice. Well, those bastards did their work in parallel, too. Not only did they bomb the system, but they broke every piece of hardware they could get their hands on, too. Khabu walked into the kitchen holding something in his hands. Reenie looked up, heart quickening. What's that?
I found this as I was leaving, caught between a lab table and the wall. It means nothing that I can see.
Reenie grabbed at the piece of paper and smoothed it. Her own name, Irene, headed the page. Below, in Susan's unmistakable shaky handwriting, were the words Otosko and Early M.
It doesn't mean anything to me,
she said after some moments.
It could have been there for months, I suppose. It may be some other Irene entirely. But we'll check it out. It's something, anyway.
Jeremiah could make no sense of it either. Reenie's momentary excitement began to fade. Khabu sat down, his face solemn.
I saw the picture in the living room again as I passed, he said. The rock painting.
He stared at the cup before him. For a moment they were all silent. Reenie thought they must look like they were conducting a seance.
I am very sorry,
he continued abruptly.
About what?
I fear that I made Dr. Von Blake feel uncomfortable about the picture on her wall. She was a good person. She valued it for what it meant, I think, even though it was not the work of her own people.
She was so good.
Jeremiah sniffed angrily and dabbed his eyes with a napkin, then wiped his nose.
Too good. She didn't deserve this. They should find these men and hang them, just like they did in the old days.
She told us something important anyway, Reenie said, and she may have left us this note. We'll do our best to find out what she learned, and if it leads us to the people that did that...
She paused, remembering the brutally impersonal thoroughness of the destruction below.
Well, I'll do whatever I can do, whatever I can do, to see them brought to justice.
Justice.
Dako said the word like it tasted bad.
When has anyone ever gotten justice in this country?
Well, let's face the facts. She was rich and she was white, Jeremiah. If anyone's murder is going to be solved by the authorities, hers will.
He snorted. Whether in disbelief or agreement, Reenie couldn't tell. They finished their tea while Jeremiah told them all the things that had to be done to prepare for the doctor's memorial service, and how much of the work had been left to him. A niece and nephew were flying in from America, and on past experience, Jeremiah fully expected to be pushed aside without thanks. His bitterness was understandable, but depressing. Reenie ate a few biscuits, more from politeness than hunger. Then she and Khabu stood up to go.
Thank you for letting us look, she said. I would have felt terrible if we hadn't at least tried.
Jeremiah shrugged.
No one will be punished for this, not as they deserve, and no one will miss her as much as I will.
Something sparked in Reenie's memory. Hold on, Jeremiah... Susan mentioned a friend named Martine, a researcher. I can't remember the last name. Deiru something?
Dako shook his head.
I do not know the name.
I know the house systems were purged, but might there be anywhere you could look? Did she keep an old-fashioned diary, a notebook, anything on paper?
Jeremiah began to shake his head again, then paused.
We have a household accounts book. The doctor always worried that there might be tax problems, so we kept duplicate records.
He bustled out of the room, his body language showing his gratitude at having something to do. Reenie and Khabu sipped at cold tea, too tired to make conversation. After about a dozen minutes had passed, Jeremiah hurried back in, carrying a leather-bound ledger.
There is one small payment from 3 years ago, credited as research to a Martine de Ruban.
He pointed.
Could that be it?
Reenie nodded.
It certainly sounds right. Any net address or number?
No.
Just the name and the amount paid.
Ah, well, it's a start.
Rini fingered the piece of folded paper, which now had the researcher's name written on it as well.
Fragments, she thought. Just bits of things. Voices in the dark. Confusing images. Names half heard. That's all we have to go on.
She sighed as Jeremiah steered onto the dark hill road. Here and there, a glow through the trees showed the location of another of Kloof's isolated fortresses. The light, as always, a display of bravery against the huge and frightening darkness. Bravery? Or was it ignorance?
Fragments.
She let her head rest against the cool window. Habu had closed his eyes.
I suppose that is all we ever have to go on.
Rini sat down on the edge of the bed to dry her hair, glad of a quiet moment by herself. The evening line for the shelter's communal shower had been long, and she hadn't been in a gossipy mood, so the 20-minute wait had made her yearn for a little solitude. As she undid the turban she had made of her towel, she checked her messages. Someone from the Poly had called to tell her she was summoned to the Chancellor's office the next day, which didn't sound like anything good. She set her search gear to work on the two names from Susan's scrap of paper. The more she thought about it, the more she wondered why Dr. Von Blake, who had spent her entire life working with information machinery, would make a written note instead of just recording a voice message on her home system. Perhaps there was more significance to Habu's discovery than she had first thought. The gear turned up a match between Atasco and Early M fast enough. A 20-year-old book in its third revision entitled Early Mesoamerica, written by a man named Bolivar Atasco. The first search through South African directories for Susan's researcher friend's name was less successful, so Rini started a worldwide investigation through the online directories for net addresses matching or close to Derubam, then returned to consider the Atasco book. As long as she was spending money she couldn't really afford, she decided, she might as well download the book itself. It was a little more expensive than normal, since it was apparently heavy on illustrations. But if Susan had left her some kind of clue, then by God she was going to find it. By the time she finished drying her hair, it was on her system. If early Mesoamerica contained some kind of message from Susan Von Blake, it did not immediately yield up the secret. It seemed to be nothing more than a work of popular anthropology about the ancient history of Central America and Mexico. She checked the index for anything that might be significant, but found nothing unusual. She scanned through the text. The color pictures of Aztec and Mayan ruins and artifacts were striking. She was particularly taken by a skull made entirely of jade, and by some of the more elaborate stone carvings portraying flower-faced and bird-clawed gods. But none of it seemed to have anything to do with her problem. A blinking light brought her attention back to her other inquiry. Nothing had turned up about anyone named Martine Derubin on any of the conventional international directories. Rini called the Poly and accessed the school's much more comprehensive search engines. If she was going to get in trouble, she might as well get the most out of it while she still could, and then returned to the Atasco book, hunting for anything that might connect the text or pictures to the mysterious city. She had no better luck this time, and began to doubt that the crumpled piece of paper had been anything other than some old research note of Susan's. She skimmed back to the introduction and was reading about the author, Bolivar Atasco, who had apparently done a lot of interesting things in a lot of interesting places, when her father returned from the store.
"Here, Papa, let me help you."
She put her pad down on the bed and went to take the bags from him.
"Did you get me some more pain blockers?"
"Yes, yes."
He said it as though shopping were an underappreciated lifelong specialty of his, instead of something he had just done for only the second or third time in his adult life.
"Got the pain blockers, got the other things. Those people in that store, they crazy. Make you stand in a line, even when you only got a few little things."
She smiled.
"Have you eaten anything?"
"No."
He frowned.
"I forgot to cook."
"I'll make you something. You're going to have to get your own breakfast tomorrow, because I'm going to work early."
"What for?"
"It was the only chance I could get for some uninterrupted lab time."
"You never home, girl."
He slumped onto the edge of his bed, looking sullen.
"Leave me here alone all the time."
"I'm trying to do something about Stephen, Papa. You know that."
She suppressed a frown as she pulled out a six-pack of beer and put it under the table, then hitched up her bathrobe and got down on her knees on the rough sisal mat to look for the vacuum sack of mealy flour.
"I'm working hard.
You doing something about Stephen at your work?
Trying to, yes.
While she fried griddle cakes on the two-ring halogen mini-range, her father pulled her pad onto his lap and scanned a few pages of early Mesoamerica.
What's this about? This whole book about some kind of Mexicans? These the people that used to cut out people's hearts and eat them?
I guess so, she said, glancing up. The Aztecs used to perform human sacrifices, yes, but I haven't had much chance to look at it yet. It's something that I think Susan might have left for me.
Huh.
He snorted and